You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest today on the podcast is Telly Whitney, who is a senior executive leader, an entrepreneur, a recognized advocate and expert on women and technology. She has over 20 years of leadership experience and was named one of Fast Company's most influential women in technology. Telly co-founded the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing Conference in 1994 and served as CEO of the nonprofit Anita Borg Institute from 2002 to September 2017. She has a new book, Rebooting Tech Culture, How to Ignite Innovation and Build Organizations Where Everyone Can Thrive. Enjoy the pod. Whitney, welcome to the podcast.
It's lovely to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
I'd love to start with how you came up in the tech industry. You got your PhD in computer science at the California Institute of Tech in 1986, and this is a booming time in Silicon Valley. So where did you land?
First of all, I was dying to come to Silicon Valley because there was this revolution happening. I was very involved with what was called VLSI at the time, which is the chips that is that whole revolution, the chip revolution, was what powers the AI that we're seeing today. And so I as soon as I got my PhD, I did come to the Valley. I worked at a research lab out of the gate, but then I worked at two startups. That was most of where my career was at, chip startups.
And I'm guessing not a lot of other women.
There were not a lot of women. And in fact, when I arrived in Silicon Valley, I systematically set out to find other women. And I connected through a group at Stanford, actually. There was a women's organization there, and I mean, many of the women I met in those early days are still very close friends, and they helped. I mean, they were my community as I still worked in a very male-dominated industry.
It's interesting for those of us who have been sort of adults through this whole period. We have this vision at a certain point in our lives, it was probably decades ago now, of an almost utopian wish for changing the world, which I think was not necessarily incorrect. And yet today we're sitting here in 2025, and, you know, it's scary in terms of what's sort of gone on in the tech industry. In many ways, it feels like what they ended up doing was taking this great man theory, which is a relic of the past, and supersizing it into right now a big danger for all of us.
It's interesting that you said that. You know, that whole utopian view about how technology could change the world in a positive way was part of my DNA. It was certainly part of many of the conversations that I was a part of during those early days. And I think of it frequently when I hear the predictions of a utopian world from where we sit today, because when you have these kind of revolutionary changes, which are part of our world, the results often look quite a bit different than what the early predictors are saying.
There's a podcast I was listening to just this morning where they had on a group that is openly saying they want to use AI to take away all jobs. That's their
right
thing. And the hosts of the podcast were basically sort of saying, you know, I just wish you might have some empathy for the fact that this, you know, there'd be loss. And these guys are like, well, there's always loss. And they're like, you know, and in this case, you know, maybe it's 30, 40 years. And I'm sitting here listening to this going, 30, 40 years is the years of someone's productive life that you're willing just to, you know, wish away because of this technology. And I'm interested in AI. I'm excited about, you know, things that it can do, but like there are no guardrails at all. And this book is so interestingly timed given that and given the, you know, where we stand in DEI, something that just 3-4 years ago felt like, nope, this is the new norm. And now suddenly we have government and others saying, no, it isn't. It's the opposite.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I actually think I listened to the same podcast that you did. And it was, the startup CEOs or the founders were completely clueless as to how their company was going to impact all these people. And as much as the host tried to get them to think about that, it never happened. I do believe that part of the push for rebooting tech culture, which is what my book is called, is about opening the tent and having more people with really great ideas help inform that technology that is coming. I mean, it is coming. And the best leaders will be inclusive. They will look for ideas for innovation from across a broad set of people. I believe that because of that, that the future could look brighter because we don't yet know how this is all going to play out.
You write in the book a really interesting thing. You say that tech culture is rooted in two myths and one obsession. The narrow ideal of what a great tech employee looks like, the myth of meritocracy, and the obsession with the lone genius. To me, that triumvirate is you have nailed exactly what the issue is. And our guest, my next guest on the podcast is a guy named Martin Dubin, who's written a book called Blind Spotting: How to See What's Holding You Back as a Leader. And he was a clinical psychologist who became an entrepreneur. And he, this is the stuff he's saying, which is like, if you don't know what your blind spots are, you're going to make a lot of really bad mistakes for yourself over a period of time. And we all have them. And that lack of humility combined, here's the problem, right? It's we all have this sort of, you know, problem as human beings. You combine that with a mythology that was never real. And that's a potion that's very hard to fight.
Yes, I mean, this idea of the lone genius is really part of the tech DNA. And if you look at Walter Isaacson and talking about the innovators, if you look at history, even though there was this myth of the lone genius, it wasn't true. Every great technologists actually had a team behind them that was working with them. And part of the best leaders like that, people like Steve Jobs, is that they actually solicited ideas from a pretty broad set of people. And that's true in technology too. And the meritocracy is interesting because some of the people who I admire greatly have talked about how there is meritocracy in Silicon Valley. But if you or a woman, or somebody who doesn't look like the normal, the icon, the ideal, I can guarantee you, you don't feel like it's a meritocracy. Mm. So it's part of Silicon Valley, and it's unfortunate because I love the ethos of Silicon Valley. This idea of entrepreneurship can really produce very positive results.
So let's talk a bit about innovation. You say in the book, quote, creativity and collaboration are the foundations of innovation. Let's break that down, because this is my field as well. It's just not in the tech field, but, you know, we create out of nothing our work, and we do it in groups, and we do it utilizing creativity, which is rife with failure. And I think people sometimes want to scrub that out, and it's impossible. So I'm curious, from your POV, when you talk about creativity and collaboration as the foundation, what are we talking about? What's the mix?
Yeah, so creativity is very interesting. It's one of the real revelations that I had when I wrote this book, is that tech companies, especially the huge tech companies, aren't so focused on creativity as much as I had thought so. And it sort of degenerates into control and command because it's much more, you know what the results are going to be. One of my favorite references is from Ed Catmull, who is more in line with what you're talking about, his Creativity Inc., where they're making films. And so he talks about how you have to have You have to create these spaces where everybody feels like they're peers at the table. And I do think that if you're really creating a culture of creativity, finding ways for everybody to voice their opinion, I mean, not all of them will bear fruit, but that's really important. And it, you're right. It doesn't just matter that for technology. That's true for any place where you're really trying to create a creative culture.
Now, you sat at tables both where your voice was heard and wasn't. What was the difference between those rooms?
Well, I think that, for me, I didn't stay at places very long if my voice wasn't heard. I mean, I must admit I was pretty unconscious of that was a driver, but if I didn't feel like I could have an influence on the outcome, I was not long at the company. And I was very lucky, and that's one of the advantages of going to small places. I was at a couple of chip startups, is that you need everybody, you know, all hands on deck, because your future, your very existence depends on people participating in those kinds of conversations. Where you see that break down, and this is more research than my own experience, is in really large companies where they want the products of tomorrow to very carefully mimic what the products of today. I mean, I've known of many companies where they had a breakthrough product that they never brought to market because it didn't fit within the products that they were offering. There's a couple of examples that come to mind.
Oh, this is where, like, they would have missed post-it notes, things like that, where, like, you had something really cool. It was unexpected, but lean into that, but they couldn't even do it because the muscle of the company wasn't working.
In fact, a very easy example is the person who created the digital camera was at Kodak. Kodak did not take his idea and make it into a real product, but he certainly created the whole industry as he showed, he demonstrated how it could work.
I'm buddies with a guy who he had been at McKinsey, and he was at the meeting where Blockbuster said no to buying Netflix for some ridiculously low number. And I I would love to have been the fly on the wall of those disastrous moments in time where that level of arrogance like took over. And I think this is at the heart. You talk about this idea of normalizing vulnerability. And I think that's the point, right? The point is, if you're a little bit vulnerable, it means you're a little bit curious, which means you might take a beat and be like, am I getting everything here? Maybe if I get input from other people, we're going to see that there's an opportunity that we're not seeing. But you don't, if you refuse to be vulnerable, you're never going to see those things.
Right. And you mentioned failure a few minutes ago. You know, failure is the biggest teacher you have. And yet many leaders are terrified of failure. But if you look at the industry overall, it's when they try something and they fail that you can then take it back and you learn more from that failure than almost all the successes that you have.
So I should mention the book has got the six C's. That's how you sort of run through the book: creativity, courage, confidence, curiosity, communication, and community. I'm very curious to talk about this relationship between courage and confidence, because they are two different things. And you suggest that you can't get to confidence without having courage. Is the reverse true as perhaps as well or not?
That you can't get to courage without confidence? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a very interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. But I feel like, so for me, courage is part of my story. I mean, this ability to take risks when you're not sure about the outcome has really, I mean, to say yes when you can, and even though you're terrified. You are correct that confidence is often that the confidence allows you to say yes, you're right, to taking a risk. But the book is about a culture of confidence, which is a little harder to create. And we have these myths that confidence looks this one particular way, and it's what it was like in the past. And I think that confidence comes in all shapes and sizes as people manifest that confidence. You know, listen to me, I want a chance.
Yeah, the way I think about this a little bit, my friend Sunil Gupta writes about this in his book Backable, where he sets up the idea that too many people think you should be leaning on charisma. And he's like, that's actually not the thing. It's sort of like competence and competence. And, you know, Steve Jobs, if you look at the tape of him launching those products, he's not a charismatic speaker. He just believes what he's saying, and you can tell. And there's many examples of this. It's like, you don't need to be a great orator for people to then be like, I want to follow this person. But it's because you can sort of feel their competence. So what I was thinking about when you wrote about that is confidence is a little bit about the fake it till you make it, which there is some science behind that. But you absolutely can't live there. You have to get to courage, which I think is more intrinsic and powerful in the long run. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And it's, once again, confidence looks different in some of your people, but this charisma, I mean, many CEOs, at least of tech companies, do have a certain level of charisma. They are able to say things that people can hear. I agree with you that for many of them, what they're exuding is competence. I can deliver on these products. There's no question. But being able to believe, first of all, they have to believe it. And yeah. They have to communicate that they believe it. And then you're right. With that, some people will take risks to follow along them.
So let's talk about curiosity. Is this something that you have had your whole life, or is it something that you had to build up?
So, I mean, curiosity is probably part of who I am. It's, I mean, I'm always wondering about this idea. I mean, some are in technology, some are just in life. I mean, I've traveled a lot. I mean, I remember when I went to Nepal and hiked to the base camp of Mount Everest. And I mean, that was driven by a certain level of curiosity of what does this look like? Yeah. I think that this can, you know, embracing curiosity and teaching your staff to embrace curiosity can really make a difference at your company, because in perfect world, that means your staff is out listening to ideas from completely different fields and seeing how those ideas can influence the product that you're developing. I just, it's something that helps all that we do all the time.
I'm curious, and I know you stepped out of technology or stepped out of being a technologist, but you were still tied to that community. One of the things I've noticed over time, and this is just with business leaders in general, so I'm curious what your POV is that it becomes increasingly harder to be curious the more success you have, the more senior you get. It feels like that requires very intentional agency on behalf of individuals to remain curious when they experience a great deal of success.
So that's probably true. As you become, especially on your way up, as you become more and more responsible for products, your bosses are depending on you to deliver results. No question about it. But I still think that many great leaders and some, many of the people that I interviewed in my book, they still found ways to introduce new ideas. I mean, I'm thinking of Mike Schroepfer at Facebook, who was at Facebook, which is now Meta. And he just brought people to talk about ideas so that his whole entire staff would, it would push their thinking in terms of paying attention to different fields. My friend Mary Lou Jepson, who was the founder of Open Waters, I mean, she really demands that you understand different fields. She demands it of herself. She demands it of her staff. And she can take, mechanical engineering and physics and computer science and bring all those ideas to the company that she started.
Can you tell us about Grace Hopper? Who was Grace Hopper?
Grace Hopper was an early computing pioneer. She was She's best known for developing the first compiler, which is a program that translates high-level language into machine code. She's probably most famous for finding the first bug in a software, because she actually found a physical bug in the computer that she was working on. And so we decided to name the conference, which we started in 94, after her, because she was one of the most prominent women computer scientists.
Interesting. All right, I want to talk about Chapter 6, which is about communication. You're at Actel, and you had to pitch a new technical idea to your CEO, and his response was, quote, "I don't get it," end quote, which is not a great thing to hear. Tell us why you told that story, and then what happened with it.
Well, so I spent so much time prepping to talk to the CEO at the time, and I was a young engineer, Kelly. I didn't get in front of the CEO and his executive staff very frequently. And so I just had a few minutes. I think I had 10 minutes. And I talked all the jargon about what I was working on, the product. And these were semiconductor guys, and I was really coming in with more of a software bent. And he had no idea what I was talking about or why it was important. He approved the budget because he believed in me. Hmm. So I did get, the software that I was asking him for, but it was really an investment in me, not in my communication. And if you think about any person who's doing their job, you can be creative. You can have courage. You can have confidence. But if you can't communicate your ideas, then most of the time it never comes to fruition. And so learning to both be able to communicate your technical ideas, being able to communicate your business ideas. I mean, we talked about Steve Jobs earlier, and part of what he needed to do was communicate this vision. And any leader has to be able to do that. Any person who wants to have an impact on their product needs to be able to do that.
So what's interesting about this is I think both things are true. I think one thing is that most people do invest in humans and the individual across them even before the idea. And that's something that we teach here. But mm-hmm. also that your ability to communicate with regard to every other facet of the work environment, you know, getting teams to back you and be on board, to understand what the goal is, to understand what priorities to do, all of that belongs in the realm of communication. I think I didn't quote this, so I imagine you say it in the book, but I also know it's true, is that men talk more at meetings than women. That's sort of scientifically been seen across the board. And my big embarrassing story with that is that we got our telephone system switched over at Second City. It's like a decade ago. And suddenly it was sending us reports that showed us at the end of a conference call how much each person talked. And this was the most humbling thing I've ever experienced in my life, because I'm like, oh no, I was like 80% of that call. That can't happen anymore. And I made real efforts in terms of not eating up all the oxygen in a room. But I imagine for women leaders, this is like a double bind, right? First of all, women aren't allowed to talk as much. And then if you're a woman leader and you're trying to get people, women to get more airtime, you get sort of in trouble for that from certain men. This had to be going on all the time for you in Silicon Valley.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I love this idea of your tool. I think that we should package it up and productize it and give it to all leaders so that they can track how much
they talk.
I'm talking.
They're not going to want it. They're not going to want it at all.
So I can't tell you the amount of coverage from a lot of people, men and women, about how to manage meetings and make sure that everybody participates. And the conscious leaders actually do try and make sure that everybody in the room participates in some fashion or another. But it has to be conscious, and it's a lot of work. It's easy to just get caught up in the ideas. I don't see, when you get the leaders, so these are people who are successful, I'm not sure you see that much difference between the men and the women mm-hmm. trying to get their team to participate. I think in both cases, what they're really eager to do is make sure that the people that they know have good ideas, actually express those ideas and find ways to do that.
So what for you was effective feedback? Because people don't want to, but they both want feedback and they don't want it, right? And we want to deliver it and we don't want to deliver it. It just doesn't feel like it's normally good. What's good feedback for you?
You mean to give to others or to give to me?
Both.
Both? Okay. So what I would say is that when you see a woman suggest something in a meeting and be ignored, and then a man come back and say, oh yeah, I think that blah, 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 and you suggest the same idea. If you're smart and savvy, you will say, yes, I think that's a great idea, Bob. I also thought that it was great when Judy suggested it a few minutes ago. So being more conscious of who's saying what is really important. This is especially true if you're the leader of the group. I had one leader that went extensively about the fact that he saw people take credit for ideas. I mean, there'd be 20 people who said this was my idea after the fact, but they are less likely to take credit early on when there was still a risk that it may or may not work. And so he made sure that the person that actually came up with the idea got credit. It was really important to him.
I had never heard of stay interviews. Can you explain what a stay interview is?
I think they're pretty common, especially at companies that are downsizing. Mm-hmm. So Colin Paris, who was a GE at the time, talked extensively how he would make sure that he talked to the people he really wanted to stay, especially if he knew that layoffs were coming. And he painted a picture of why it was in their best interest to stay, the kind of responsibilities that they would be given. And so he really addressed them. And I think they're a pretty powerful tool for all of us, that you've got a large group of people who work for you. And if you have a conversation with the people who you really want to make sure stay, they can see their future in your company's future.
So I'm curious, you probably started writing this book, what, 3 years ago?
Yes.
So talk about that journey. Again, we referred to this in terms of the way the world is now versus what it was 3 years ago. Was there a moment where you're like, I'm putting down the pen, or did it just say, no, that's even more important for me to get these ideas out?
Yeah, well, you know, you must remember that this whole craziness is this year. So the book was published. It was really just not released. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the chance of saying, oh my goodness, this is not the book that I want to write. But I had seen, I mean, the history came because I saw so many women coming to Grace Hopper and being so excited about technology and having ideas about where they would go. And so many of them then left. I saw that time after time. And then through the organization, I also had the chance to meet these remarkable leaders who were different, doing it differently. They were approaching developing technology in a way that was inclusive. And although I was very familiar with the women coming into technology, I made a decision years ago that the book was about inclusion. It's really about making sure that all ideas come to fruition, but also about innovation. I mean, that to me is something that we forget, that really we're the reason that all these technologies companies are trying to exist is because of they want to create an innovative product.
For members of our audience who maybe don't know, can you talk about some of the ways that bias creeps into technology and creates problems for us?
Well, there's so many great ways you see this happening. So for one, I mean, if you do all your testing on men, then that means when your customers, who are much more than men, try and use it, they find that it doesn't work. And you see this with voice recognition. Uh-huh. Years ago, they had a voice recognition software that had a much harder time recognizing women's voices. A few years ago, there was a company that had this great recruiting tool that used AI, but it was using all the data from its past And so it was completely biased about anybody, for anybody. These are engineers that weren't men. I mean, it was so embarrassing. They took the product off the market. So those are a couple of ways that you see bias. But I mean, same thing with the phone when it was first designed. How do you, the phone was designed, the iPhone was designed to fit in a male pocket. And so women struggled with what to do with it. So those are some of the ways that you see it, the product itself.
Yeah, seatbelts, facial recognition technology, these are all things that have been problematic because of that. All right, interesting.
They have, yes.
Okay, we always ask our guests to end the podcast with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yes, I do. So, I mean, my whole DNA, I was a technologist, and I was very much involved in these startups that I mentioned. And my friend Anita Borg founded the Institute for Women in Technology, and she was diagnosed with brain cancer. And so she actually couldn't stay at the nonprofit that had just been formed. But I was adamant about wanting to stay working in technology when the board came to me and asked me. And so I said no. And then I went home and I talked to my husband, who had great advice. And I said, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I could make a difference. And so I decided to expand my view of what I could do by taking on the role of a very early startup. I mean, this nonprofit was just did not have a funding model. Most of the board, I didn't know this at the time, didn't think it would exist after a year.
Wow.
And I turned it into a very successful nonprofit. I mean, when I stepped down, the budget was $28 million, which for a nonprofit is pretty good sized.
That's great. The book is called Rebooting Tech Culture, How to Ignite Innovation and Build Organizations Where Everyone Can Thrive. Telly Whitney, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Aridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.